Welcome to the Revaluation Podcast, the podcast about the future of science policy and its evaluation. Nice to have you with us. My name is Isabella Wagner.
And I am Tobias Dudenbastel. And together we are doing this podcast for the Austrian Platform for Research and Technology Policy Evaluation, the FTEVAL.
The FTEVAL platform supports exchange between the different actors in research policy in Austria and beyond since more than 25 years. And with this podcast, we now have a new medium to do that.
And for this episode today, we are supported by the Austrian Federal Ministry for Labor and Economy. And thank you very much for your support.
Thanks so much. This is our fourth episode, the fourth episode of the Revaluation Podcast, and it's about causality. So we're trying to find out how to statistically understand what results in what. And we prepared a keynote speech.
Paul Hünnemann today from the Copenhagen Business School.
Which was held at the Revaluation Conference last year in May 2022.
Right. And inspired by the plea for more trials that we are going to listen to shortly afterwards, we are today also trying something new. And that is doing this episode in English to maybe expand our reach. Now, none of us are actually English mother tongue speakers, so please bear with us and we will see how this episode resonates out there.
Yeah, so this is, of course, statistically perfectly designed clinical trial, and we will then compare the performance of the different episodes, the English ones and the German ones. And depending on which ones have more listeners, we will keep or drop the English language moderation. Let's see what happens.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and today we are learning about one approach on how to close the gap between correlation of things towards saying something more about causality of things. So
Okay, wait, hang on. So what you're saying is, you have this nice statistical data set and it tells you statistical significant results of, I don't know, two things correlate and they come together, meaning like the example, the very, very commonly known example in Paul gives in his talk is there's a strong correlation between the appearance of storks and the delivery of babies. So do storks actually bring babies? And then you see, okay, yeah, there is a solid statistical correlation, but the causality is not that storks bring babies, but just there are more storks and more babies in summer.
Yeah, so you expect that there is maybe something else influencing both of these valuables and bringing them up, but you don't see that in your data. To get closer to say something about whether it's just a correlation or it's a causality, that is what Paul Hünnemann is trying to do.
Yeah, that's other people are trying to do that too. So people like us, these mixed method people, people like us would go about this and do some qualitative interviews and try to understand how to interpret the data in a meaningful way. And like the really cool guys, the ones with statistical deep knowledge, they would try to create a model that explains the causalities, and they would then correlate and see like what factors influence what in that statistical correlation. And how to do that, like a lot has been published of how to do that, and there are several methods that can be explained. We will mention we will give you references afterwards where to find more about these methods. But Paul, in his talk, basically pleads for doing more experiments, especially in research funding. So you have a group that is treated with a certain, I don't know, funding mainly, I guess, and a control group that is not. And then you compare which one performs more, and then you understand what the actual effect of the intervention was. And that's a cool thing to do, but it can also be quite resource-consuming, depending on, and it takes some time, and it needs to be cleverly done. And also, it's quite a diligent task, so it's a tricky task to do. So we talked in advance that when we prepared this session, we asked ourselves, do we actually want to be in the control group? So do we want to, like, once we found out that we were not treated as nicely as the others, so, and then maybe our innovation business goes bankrupt, would we want to, and what we would be, we might be angry. When we it's also a moral thing how to nicely do that.
Exactly. And it's also, I mean, for agency implementing such a scheme, that also means treating a subset of their customers you know, less preferably. So it's also maybe a competitive or competition law thing that needs to be considered there when deciding about these kind of trials.
True, could be the case. And the other thing is that, as in all evaluation cases, of course, but particularly in the trial and experimental settings, you must be aware of how you evaluate right at the beginning when you set an intervention. So you plan the evaluation together with the intervention. So that's also something. So there must be, so Paul actually really pleads for a whole culture of experimentation in the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But maybe, so there are a lot of tricky questions to be answered in this field, and the speech of Paul, I think some answers are in there. But before we get to these very tricky questions, let me ask you a simple question, Isabella. Who is Paul Hünemund?
Paul Hünemund is assistant professor at the Copenhagen Business School in the Department of Strategy and Innovation, and he deals a lot with decision-making and like how to base your decision on what, and he even deals with AI mechanisms to do that. And interesting guy, very active on Twitter, so I hope he will listen to a podcast.
Exactly, yeah. And Paul, he has held the keynote speech for the FTWL conference on the second day, so this is what we're going to listen to later on. But on the conference, this was not the only contribution to this kind of topic, because there was also a relevant session that came later on.
Right, and it was organized by our colleagues of the WIFO, of the Austrian Institute for Economic Research. And they held a session on new data sources and empirical methods in research and innovation policy evaluation. And there were two contributions that were also published in the conference proceedings, so you could take a look at them. One was by Mathieu Brun of BPI France. It's the Innovation Agency of France, and they did some trial and like highly deeply statistical things to evaluate the intervention. And also one by colleagues of the FFG, of the Austrian Research Promotion Agency. So it's an Austrian case where Tess Lenden and Harald Hochreiter made like first experiments with experiments.
Exactly.
Interesting cases. Please take a look at them. Yeah, so that was the revaluation conference. And before we let you alone with Paul, we wanted to give you some like further reading and places where you can inform yourself a bit more about the different statistical methods from and research and innovation point of view, so for intervention in research policy. And these are, on the one hand, an event we held at the FTWL platform on econometrics.
And that is also online, and you can listen to that if you want to learn more about the topic. And that was organized by four people, Dirk Czarnicki from the ZEW and Hannah Hottenroth, who gave a little bit a methodological overview on state-of-the-art approaches there. And there are also in there two examples of applications. And that is by Jens Storm, I think it was from Denmark, from Ministry there, and Theo Roland from DG Enterprise and Innovation and the Dutch Ministry. So an example from Denmark and an example from the Netherlands.
Yeah, that was highly interesting. And we will, of course, share all the links in our show notes. And the final resource we want to highlight is the Experimental Research Funders Handbook that was published by the RORI community, by the Research on Research Institute. And that really nicely pulls together what you must know if you're a research funder and try to experiment with experiments like the FFT did. So this is these are really, really, really cool resources to start from. And of course, we are always curious to get your feedback on this episode and to see how it's relevant for you. And yeah, now we wish you good fun and enlightening impulses by Paul Hünemund.
Exactly. Have fun listening, have fun reading later on.
Hello. Thanks for having me here. I was asked to talk about methodology, quantitative methods on a Friday morning by the organizers. That's not on me. But I will try to keep it as light as possible. So what I want to talk about today is SDI policy and the concept of causality and why that concept is, in my view, so important for SDI policy evaluation. And impact, that's the ubiquitous word, of course. We can debate the definition. Actually, we had a little debate yesterday already over the conference dinner, but I definitely heard that word throughout the entire day yesterday. We strive, certainly as academics, for impact, but also with our policies, R&D policies that we enact. And, impact at its core, again, we can have a long debate about the definition, but at its core, it's a counterfactual concept. If I hadn't pushed those domino stones, I wouldn't have created this chain reaction that led to a certain outcome, right? That's how we use this word in everyday language, impact. And that relates to SDI policy. So I looked here at the strategic objectives of just one of those policy initiatives. It's a Eurostars program. Those strategic objectives were formulated around 2008. I took this because it's a program I'm well aware of, but I could have chosen many other examples. And it's a bit small here, but I will highlight some of the key terms for you here. So we have, let's see how that works. We have stimulate development, creating a sustainable European R&D support, again, create, promote development. And all of these terms have some form of causal interpretation, right? Causal interpretation, we want to create, stimulate innovation activities in firm. We want to stimulate, foster a sustainable transformation. Well, and again, this counterfactual notion, you also see it here, because usually counterfactual, I use the very peculiar grammatical structure. If I wouldn't have pushed the stones, right? It's a bit complicated if clauses in English. You see that over here, because we want to encourage participating SMEs to create new economic activities faster than they would have than otherwise would have been possible. Okay? So here you see again the counterfactual concept of impact. Now we can look at how do we then evaluate these kind of policy initiatives. Okay. And there, the state of the art is rather bleak. This is taken from a book that has just been released, an edited volume by Christian Sandström and Carl Wenberg in Sweden. It's called, the paper is called Evaluations of Innovation Policy or Evaluating Evaluations of innovation policy, a bit of a mouthful. And they looked at 110 policy reports that have been written in the space of R&D policy and how they have been evaluated. And this was a striking graph here that I took from this paper. We see that predominantly the evaluations that we do are of qualitative nature. So that means some form of interviews or desk research. And those methods, they have a lot of advantages, right? They allow us to really go to the micro-level processes, look at the mechanisms that are at play, but they're not very good at assessing a counterfactual impact. So if you were a PhD student starting out at CBS, and you would ask me how should I write or what should I write my thesis about, and you want to go into qualitative methods, I would tell you exactly that. Focus on the mechanisms and the processes at play. But if you want to assess counterfactual impact, you probably want to go more towards the quantitative side. And we see that, right? There are many approaches that use, for example, a mixed methods approach. But then digging deeper into that space of the quantitative methods, we see that especially quantitative counterfactual studies, they're really in the minority. Just 9 out of 110, I believe it was in total. Okay? So we're not doing counterfactual evaluation as often as probably we should, given that we actually strive for a counterfactual impact. Okay, so hashtag causality, right? So I will talk about this concept a bit more. How can we make those kind of counterfactual assessments and why it is so important? Well, to start out, here's an important question. Do storks deliver babies? Okay, I'll let you digest the graph for a second because the data certainly says so. Okay, if we look at here it's a bit of old data from the 80s and 90s, but if we look at the number of stork breeding pairs in 17 European countries and we regress that against the birth rates in those countries, we see actually a strong positive correlation between those two. Strong positive, significant, even though it's just 17 countries, the p-value is well below 1%. Okay? So, well, is that the answer? I guess you've already had some ideas when looking at that. Probably not, right? Probably the impact of the stork population on birth rates is expected to be rather marginal. Well, and you can see that here, once you account for things like population area or population density in total, right? This, well, it's a regression output. You don't need to understand everything that is here, but you see that this variable stork becomes insignificant then. So this strong positive correlation that we have in the raw data depicted here goes away once we account for other influence factor. And I guess that's intuitive, right? Well, and that leads us already to an important principle in these kind of quantitative evaluations. It's the confounding problem. Okay? So here, that's a graph we've taken from a paper that Dirk Chernitsky, my former PhD supervisor at KU Leuven, and I wrote, Innovation Policy and Causality, where we tried to make this concept clear in a as brief manner as possible. So what we're aiming for is some form of R&D policy. Here we're looking at R&D grants, could be tax policies as well, and the impact of those policies on firm growth and innovation. That's here the outcome on the right-hand side. So what we want to assess is sort of this arrow down here. Yesterday I've heard a bit of rhetoric against sort of a linear idea of causality, right? That doesn't have to be here, right? It doesn't have to be a linear idea of causality. There could be feedback loops involved, just as a side note. Okay, but that's not all that is happening here. Again, with the storks and the birth rates, right? We have other variables that jointly affect those variables that we're interested in. And they're plentiful, right? Like here on top, we've just listed a few: firm size, firm age, prior firm performance, R&D intensity, industry, and so forth. The list, you could go on and on and on. And if you don't account for these variables, right, you're literally comparing apples to oranges, right? Like if you don't account for example, prior firm performance, some firms have much more experience with R&D policy, you're comparing apples to oranges. Okay, so you can do that, that's fine. It's just like I did before, right? I accounted for area population and suddenly this sort of nonsense, silly correlation went away, so that's nice. The problem is that many of those characteristics will be unobservable, at least to the analyst that is analyzing the data, or even to you as sort of the administrators, maybe some of the room, that are administering these kind of programs. Right? So here on the lower side, we see unobservable firm characteristics, could be project quality. Maybe we have some rough proxies for it, but in general, it's hard to observe this kind of variable. Management quality, entrepreneurial orientation of the startup, and so forth. Okay. So, important side note here, when we do these kind of evaluations, right, and you have access to, for example, proxies about project quality from the proposals, right, the written text, give as much information as you have to the evaluators. That's the first advice. But that has limits, right, because some of these characteristics will be unobservable even to the project administrators. How does the scientific literature deal with this? Well, the state of the art is the so-called regression discontinuity design, and there, that's the only time I want to get a bit more technical, because I want to give you the intuition for this kind of evaluation approach. How does a standard R&D subsidy scheme, for example, look like? Well, we have a bunch of applications that come in, right? Those applications get evaluated by independent technical experts. They get often a quantitative score, and then we rank those projects, right? Implicitly, there's always sort of a project quality ranking involved. And then we go through the list, and every program has, of course, a certain budget, so we go as far. At one point, there's no budget left anymore, and, well, the marginal firm, as we say in econ, right, will then not be funded anymore. If you depict that in a graph here, and you have project quality on the x-axis, you see that, well, what we call the treatment probability, so the probability of getting funded, jumps here from zero, right? Those are the firms where we're out of budget, to one sharply. Okay, that's why this RDD is actually also called a sharp regression discontinuity design. Treatment probability jumps from zero to one. Okay, and then the idea is that here at this discontinuity, this dashed line, right? Firms just below that cutoff and above the cutoff, right? They will be similar in all sorts of respects. Okay, so this kind of discontinuity creates almost like a quasi experiment, a natural experiment, and even though we have many of those unobserved variables that we cannot account for, but we're saying that, well, here just below and just above this threshold, these firms will be on average comparable. Okay, that's, in a nutshell, the idea of a regression discontinuity design. Well, it's a great technique because it arises so naturally in R&D policy. That's why it's sort of the state of the art, but it has some limitations. First of all, well, you already see it. We can't compare firms that are here to firms that are here, for example. Right here, this kind of idea that they're close to the discontinuity and that therefore similar in all sorts of respects wouldn't hold anymore. So we have to shrink our sample massively. Right? Let's say in total this program was funding 5,000 firms, which is already a lot. If we go very close to this discontinuity, we might be left with 100 and 200. So that gives a sort of statistical uncertainty. The second thing, or the second problem, goes a bit deeper because, well, we are estimating something for this group that is here in the red zone. And the treatment effect that we get out will be specific for that group. Here's a graph from a paper that we published 2019, again, Dirk Chinitsky and I, in Research Policy. We looked at the Eurostars program, that's why I'm familiar with that program very well, and we looked at the treatment effect of that program here on employment growth. So on the right-hand side is the additionality effect on employment growth. The two means they hire two additional employees per year. And normally, this kind of treatment effect is actually one number. Okay, so we're estimating an average treatment effect, that's it. In this paper, we were actually able to unpack that, and we could look at the treatment effect, how it varies with project quality. So we had an indicator project evaluation score, which is our proxy for project quality. And you see that it varies quite substantially. It goes from something close to zero, right, and the confidence intervals overlap zero, so there will be statistically a null effect, to something that is statistically significant and also economically large. Like, these were SMEs, and they grew by two additional employees per year. Well, but now it depends if you would run a regression discontinuity design on this kind of data, right? Where does this threshold actually lie that you explore, right? Is it here? Then you would infer sort of a null effect of the Eurostars program, and you would go to the commission and say, you know, cancel that program, it's not worth it. If the threshold would lie here, you would say, great, best program ever, okay, continue to put money into this. Well, and that's a problem, right? You can already see that treatment effect heterogeneity in this regression discontinuity design is a big problem. So it's what we call internally valid. It gives you a causal estimate out, but the generalizability of this kind of program is very, very limited, even within the same kind of R&D policy. Because this threshold here in red is solely determined by the amount of funding that is available, right? It could have been the left one or the right-hand one. We don't know. Okay, where to move forward from there? So I want to make, in the last 5 minutes, 5 proposals. Okay, first, I think we need to build and we need to strive for more of a culture of experimentation. Okay, this is here the so-called scientific Maryland scale that you see. It's sort of a way to assess how suitable quantitative methods are in assessing a counterfactual impact, a causal effect of a program. And you see it starts here with a correlation analysis that would be the stocks and the birth rates. Okay, just correlating those two variables. It goes to before and after comparison. Difference and differences, IV approaches, and on the top, there are the randomized control trials. Okay, I've taken this from actually the What Works group in the UK. It's an initiative led by Nesta UK. They've done a report a few years back, I think 2016 or so. They looked at 1,700 evaluation studies, so much larger than the Swedish example that we've seen. And what they came up with is that among those 1,700 studies, just a minority was actually suitable to be classified in that way. Most of the evaluations were, again, qualitative. And only 39 studies managed to score here at level 3, and only 4 at level 4. Zero, none at level 5. Okay, and I think since then I haven't seen much progress in this area. I think we need to do better. We need to do more randomized control trials also in R&D policy evaluation. Well, just quickly, how do RCTs solve this kind of confounding problem that I've mentioned? Well, we decide basically by a flip of a coin, right? It's randomized who is going to be in the green or in the blue group. And then even though here the picture might be a bit misleading, right? These firms, they might be still very different within the group. Right? They're not all these shapeless forms. But on average, and that's the important part, because we decide by a flip of the coin, on average, these kind of groups will be comparable. And if I make the groups large enough, then I can solve this confounding problem. I don't need to care about these unobserved confounders anymore. Well, experimentation in this space is hard. Right, because we're talking about big sums of money decided, allocated by a flip of a coin, taxpayers' money. There might be a lot of legal obstacles to do this kind of experimental evaluation. Well, what I propose, I think what works in our benefit is we can do this not at large scale, right? Already pilot studies would be suitable and helpful. Because if done right, we actually don't need a big sample in these kind of experiments, right? Like 30, 40, maybe 50 is already good enough. So that's the first thing, right? We can make just the pilot studies smaller. And second, we could perhaps work with a reduced, let's say, grant size. Although that has problems too, because we would like to experiment on the real thing, right? We don't want to experiment with sort of something artificial. We would like to have evidence for the real impact. What is more important, I think we need to just change our culture and our mindset about this, right? We need to see experimentation as an investment in cumulative knowledge production. Because, well, yeah, it might cost something to hand out grants in an experimental fashion, right, and not hand select projects that we think might have the largest impact. But we need to see that as an investment in what works. That's why the report was called that way. And from that, we learn how to do better R&D policies in the future. So that's an investment in cumulative knowledge that can be done within one agency, right? Like in larger countries, DLR in Germany, TECIS in Finland, and so forth. But I think we need to do this also across agencies, across countries, right? So we need to sort of a division of labor in this kind of knowledge investment space. Okay, I need to hurry up a bit. Related to this is, I think we need to not just focus on the whether R&D policy works, but on the how and why. Because, in this paper, Innovation Policy and Causality, we actually looked at the scientific literature. And if you take this kind of causal identification carefully, then you see that, out of all these studies that usually show a very strong positive correlation, right, those that assess a counterfactual impact come to a much more mixed picture. But still, since then, we did this 3 years ago, more and more studies are coming in, and I think sort of a picture for a positive additionality effect is emerging also in the scientific literature. But that's not the main question. The main question is we want to know when R&D policy works and under which circumstances, for which firms, in which regions, what kind of characteristics play a role. And then we face a methodological problem again, because think of this as the population of firms that we're dealing with, right? And in the standard experiment, we would divide those two or those firms in two groups and then assess the impact within those two groups, much like on the slide that I've shown you before. If you focus on the how and why, we actually want to further divide that group up and say, like, now we're not just looking at treated and untreated, but also SMEs, treated as SMEs versus treated large firms, or firms within a specific region, or firms within a specific industry. And suddenly we divide that whole pie up in smaller and smaller sizes. And, the takeaway is here just what you can learn from one study will be limited. So again, we need this kind of division of labor across agencies. And I think, that's why I'm happy I'm speaking to the policy evaluation group here. I think that is where we can have a real impact. Okay, very quickly, I'm out of time. I think one striking result of this report that I showed you at the beginning, the Swedish study, was that many of the evaluations we do out of the 110 done in Sweden were actually just midterm reports. Okay, so they were evaluating the program at midterm, and naturally that focuses more on sort of implementation procedures and these kind of things, not long-term outcomes. Right? And I think we need to do better there. Here's an example from development economics where they looked at achievements of students in Pakistan over 15 years. I don't think we need to go that far, but a little bit more long-term outcomes would be nice. Okay, that's my overall summary, these 5 points, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Paul. We still have 3 minutes, and you hinted to some of the wounds which we really have in our community. For instance, this collaboration in Europe, and also the last point was, of course, extremely, extremely important. I collect two. So, first, Michael.
Paul, I'm a founder. I found it very attractive what you said. 2 points. First, we can learn a lot from the developmental aid area. I think they have, in some respects, better evaluation methods than we have. Second point, a few years ago, I was with a large German foundation at a discussion with quantitative evaluators. And there the discussion was in a way that it ended in a disagreement because the evaluators, people like Hans-Dieter Daniel and others, said, well, you funders, please make only funding programs that are designed that we then can make control group trials. So the main policy rationale should be the evaluability of the programs. And then there was a fist fight. Yeah. So how could we think of other ways of convincing funding organizations to do these experiments? That's my question. Sorry for the long question.
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. I think, I mean, yeah, it will be a long uphill battle. In this country, I know, I mean, there's this platform for Registerforschung, right, like making data available already. That's like a different area, but like there you see how long it takes to actually create this shift in culture. But I think if we want to have real impact as a policy evaluation community, it would be there, in my view.
Okay. Nick, happy birthday, first of all, to you. So, congratulations. Final question.
Thank you. Paul, thank you very much. Indeed, I want to follow up. The World Bank is running randomized controlled trials for some time now. And there are reports about it, and I think this community can learn from that. Second, in our field, actually, people like Adam Jaffe have talked about this now for decades. Adam, unfortunately, has left the field, I think, but this has been a serious discussion. The thing is, when we allocate money from programs, we don't need really to follow randomized class for the whole sample. Some proposals are obviously excellent. Some proposals are obviously very bad. The big question is right in the middle, right? That's where the evaluators have a problem. People who are exactly at the margin, some fall below, some fall, and that's where the randomized thing, randomization is really important. Yeah?
That's the Heckman argument, that a local average treatment effect that you would get out of a regression discontinuity design is sort of the policy relevant effect, because it's the one, the firm at the margin, right? That's marginally funded. I don't 100% agree, because if we look, for example, at this graph that we found for the Eurostars program, well, we couldn't really identify it because the confidence intervals get large. But what you see is actually a downturn here again. And that makes sense from a theoretical perspective, because these are the really good project, like you say, right? The really fancy AI, whatever it is, the greatest technology ever. If you're thinking about a counterfactual impact, you could think that those projects, they could have found funding somewhere else as well. So actually, then you would expect that sort of, the treatment effect is somewhere in the middle, and we actually don't want to get those very great projects, because they could get funded, for example, on the market, find private investors and so forth. So I don't 100% agree with the sentiment that, we only need to look at those middle firms, but generally, yeah, we're in agreement.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks a lot, Paul.
This was episode 4 of the Re-Evaluation podcast for the Austrian Platform for Research and Technology Policy Evaluation. So if you're curious and want to listen to more of our episodes, then please just find us on all the relevant platforms and podcast feeds that are out there, and also feel free to recommend us to other listeners.
Of course, we're always happy about your feedback and ideas for more. So please get in touch via podcast@ftval.at.
And all information to other FDVAL services, but also to the FDVAL repository with all the evaluation studies in the SDI area here in Austria, but also the FDVAL journal, for example, you find on the FDVAL website, which is www.fdval.at.
And that's also where you can subscribe to our newsletter and never miss a new episode.
Exactly, yeah, and today we thank you very much for listening in and say goodbye. My name is Tobias Dudenbostel.
And I'm Isabelle Wagner. Ciao!
Ciao!